Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. Everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Parkstone? Y'all like Parkstone? Parkstone, who is played at the Historic Arkansas Museum, among other places, is made up of Marvin Schwartz on mandolin, Ted Williams on flute, Alan Alverson on fiddle, and David Cardwell on guitar. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Scotty Shively with this piece right over here entitled The Blue and Gold. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Scotty at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories center around the need for speed, whether out of control, acceleration, or planned. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Emily Noah's speedy encounter comes very unexpectedly. And we'll end the night with Brian Thompson as his need for hastening becomes glaringly obvious. But let's start the night with Martine Carroll, as his need for speeding up is literally a matter of life and death in Up, Up, and Away.
Memphis Center, 7411 Golf. Clear the airspace. I have to hit the deck. The wings and my windshield of my Cessna 172 are frozen solid with ice. As pilots, we train for this type of event and pray it never happens. But that day it did, with my new wife, Deborah, sitting right beside me. We were over central Mississippi. The altimeter reading came from cruising at 8,000 feet to now trying to climb to 10,550 feet. If we're going to make it, we would have to quickly increase our altitude. The engine was straining to keep us aloft, and without any oxygen on board, it was just a matter of time before I might not be able to think clearly. Memphis Center finally responded, "Is this an emergency?" Deborah and I looked into each other's eyes. We were equally frightened. The ominous black clouds surrounding us were filled with ice crystals. We couldn't see through the windows as ice continued to coat the windshield and the wings. We had left Tallahassee early in the morning, my weather briefing only reporting slight ice forming at altitude 7,500 feet. Slight ice, my Aunt Martha. 50 miles out of Greenville, Mississippi, and I shouted again at Memphis Center. "What does the area above me look like? I have to climb out of this ice before losing control of the plane." We hadn't seen the ground for some time, and I was flying totally by cockpit instruments for what seemed like hours, although it had only been minutes. The airspeed, engine RPMs, altimeter, magnetic compass, and level indicator are not to be trusted in freezing conditions. And it's only 30 minutes without fresh oxygen in the cabin before altitude sickness sets in. The limits of a single engine Cessna 172 is 10,500 feet. And at 10,000 feet, there were still no visible cloud openings through the ice-crusted windshield. The leading wing edges needed to be clear to keep the aircraft aloft. Wind passing over the wings from the propeller was failing miserably. It looked like the struts holding up the wings would collapse at any moment. They were drooping like a bird that had been in the air too long. The pitot tube to measure airspeed was frozen solid, so airspeed had to be estimated by the sound of the engine. We were not producing enough airlift to keep airborne much longer. "Hold on, Deborah, this may be it," I said over the headphones, not knowing what would happen next. She began digging in her purse frantically. "What are you looking for now?" Deborah peered out the window. She wiped tears from her eyes and responded, "I'm looking for a piece of paper to write a note to my boys and tell them how much I love them." With a remorseful look, she continued, "Guess they would never find a little piece of paper if we fell out of the sky at 10,000 feet. Slamming the contents back in her purse, she cupped the sides of her seat with both hands and immediately broke out in a familiar childhood tune at the top of her lungs as if she expected God to hear her. "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." Well, just between you and me, her singing skills are not exactly the best. Yet she sung it over and over and over while I worked frantically and tried to get Memphis back on the radio. My anxiety was as high as this altitude. Suddenly, I could no longer hold the plane up, and with the nose headed down, we started falling from the sky like a rock. I yelled into the radio at Memphis Center, "Clear the deck, we're coming down." Counting the seconds down to 6,500 feet were the longest seconds of a lifetime. We'd been flying instrument over the clouds for hundreds of miles, and now we're falling helplessly. I screamed for Deborah to take the yoke while I frantically looked at the maps in an attempt to locate nearby airports where we might be able to land. Out of nowhere, an unfamiliar voice over the radio filled the cockpit. "Cessna 7411 Golf, this is Captain Lewis, listening just out of Greenville, headed for Birmingham. We just passed 6,500 and through 1,000 feet of inverted warm airspace. You should be good at 6,000 feet. Falling, falling, falling over the noise of a whining engine and my heart pounding in my chest, I noticed that Deborah stopped singing, was holding on to my arm while I was fighting the yoke. Then magic. The ice blew off the windshield and wings in a big sheets, as though an angel had suddenly wiped them clean with a squeegee. The icy rain stopped, and we were cushioned in a pocket of warm air. All the instruments began to function, and the engine sounds were humming harmoniously at a new speed. We both let out, "Hallelujah!" more than once. It was still raining, but now it was rolling off the plane. "Memphis, Cessna 7411 Golf, we made it, and all is well. Now heading for Little Rock. Thank you for your assistance." "Captain Lewis, if you're still out there, thank you also." We didn't talk much of the rest of the way, but our hearts were leaping in our chests with joy and released frustrations. We could see the tower shining green and then white through the rain and better visibility. Memphis Center handed us off to Little Rock Airport, and when we landed, there were men dressed in raincoats with flashlights to direct us to the tie-downs at Central Flying Service. It's like when your child gets lost. When you see them, you don't know whether to be mad or happy. Deborah gave me one of those looks. Trying to have a positive attitude as we were taxiing down to our tie-downs, I said, "Let's get a cup of coffee and finish the trip back to Hot Springs." "No! Are you kidding me? We are renting a car because I'm not going to get back in that plane with you for $1 million. With her hands firmly planted on those little defiant hips, I knew it wouldn't do any good to try to make her get back in the plane. And to be honest, a sturdy car with four wheels on the ground was comforting to me also. After coffee, we drove over the mountains back to Hot Springs. Deborah's head rested on my shoulder as our headlights made out of the road in front of us. And in the quiet of the car, I could still hear a faint, "Jesus loves me, this I know."
Originally from St. Petersburg, Florida, Dr. Martine Carroll has been a psychologist in Hot Springs, Arkansas for over 40 years. He loves singing in a barbershop quartet, playing with grandchildren, and being Santa Claus. Next, let's go with Emily Noah as she inadvertently gets trapped on acceleration itself in "Houston, We Have a Passport."
The waves of nervousness began as soon as I sat in the back seat of my friend Meredith's dad's car, and we pulled away from their Houston suburb home and toward the small ranch where we were going to spend the morning riding horses. I was a junior at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, and Meredith had invited me and three of our friends to road trip to her hometown for spring break. After the 10-hour drive the day before, we had rejoined in her parents' kitchen that morning for breakfast, where Meredith's dad explained that there was an older gentleman he went to church with who hassled him every Sunday about bringing friends and family out to ride his horses. Jim lived on a small ranch outside of Houston, and when he learned Meredith would be home visiting for a week with her college friends, he insisted we come out for a horseback ride. "Girls, I know it might not be your ideal plans," her dad had said, "and I can tell him no, but it would mean the world to Jim if y'all went out there today." The four of us girls immediately said yes. We were young, spontaneous, fun college students who on this day were going to live out every young girl's equestrian dreams. The only time I hesitated was when I got dressed and realized that I only had Converse sneakers and skinny jeans. Incidentally, unlike what appears to be every Texan in the history of Texas, the only people in Arkansas who wear cowboy boots are boys who own cows. Obviously, I didn't own a pair, but then I put on my plaid shirt, braided my hair into two pigtails, and smiled at myself in the mirror, confident that I looked like I knew something about horses, or at least looked like less of an amateur. However, now that we were on the way there, my nervousness did not match my friend's excitement. The only experience I had with horses was riding one in a circle attached to a rope at a petting zoo, and the two jumping over a rainbow on my second grade Lisa Frank folder. I decided to slowly announce my nervousness to the car. "Hey, guys, I'm not so sure about this anymore. Horses are very large and uncontrollable creatures, you know." The girls assured me I was being ridiculous and had nothing to worry about. We pulled up to the small farmstead. Jim was in his 60s with a terrific beer gut and a cowboy hat, boots, and a belt buckle that screamed, "Texas." We met the three horses we would be riding. They were older creatures, past their prime, but still magnificent. And their magnificence made me all the more nervous. My friends giggled as they bravely befriended the horses and noticed my skepticism. It took some time, but I began warming up to one. I fed him carrots and we bonded because his mane and my hair color matched perfectly. Meredith decided to ride first, and while the rest of us petted the horses' noses, Jim gave Meredith instructions on the reins and saddle. I wasn't listening too carefully, but from what I overheard, it struck me that Jim was not a details man. He told Meredith the horses knew the path and what speed to take. We watched as she rode, and her face looked bored as the horse slowly carried her around the fence. She came back, and I decided to ride next. It was a miracle I managed to get in the saddle. I was ready for my further instructions from Jim, but I was simply told, "Oh, you heard everything I said to her. He knows what to do." And we were off. With each step the horse took, my confidence grew. Horseback riding was really simple, almost dull, I thought, as I rode alongside the fence. I will never have an explanation for the next thing that happened. When the horse had taken me to the turnaround point on the path, it suddenly started running at a speed at which I thought my face was melting off. And if my mother was there, she would have described the horse looking like a bat out of hell. I learned a lot about myself in the next 3 minutes. I learned that in life-threatening situations, I'm not a screamer, more of a forget-to-breathe-while-your-eyes-bulge-out-of-your-head type. I also learned just how little I know about horses. I was so terrified for my life that I clung onto the horse as tightly as I could, which included me digging my feet into its sides. Anyone with an ounce of more equestrian knowledge than me knows this is slamming your foot on the gas pedal in horse language. As we flew by alongside the fence, I saw the shocked faces of my friends and Meredith's dad blur past. At this point, I silently prayed, "God, if you want to take me now," and that's how it was looking, "that's fine, but wow, I really never would have guessed death via horseback riding. Well played, it's a pretty cool way to go out." Next, Jim attempted to jump out in front of the horse and grab the reins, but was unsuccessful. It was about this time that I noticed the horse was racing towards the shed where his stall was. The shed was wooden and had a metal roof that stuck out about the height of my neckline from where I was sitting. I peacefully accepted the fact that I would soon be decapitated on a horse at the age of 21 while on spring break in Houston, Texas, and that my funeral would be closed casket. I imagined Meredith's father calling my parents and having to explain to both of them that I lost my head while on an uncontrollable horse, and already knew they'd be more shocked that I rode a horse than that I was dead. We were about 6 feet from the shed when I closed my eyes and hoped to see the pearly gates. Suddenly, we weren't in motion anymore, and when I opened my eyes, I realized that I had miraculously ducked in a style that must have been the perfect mixture of Jackie Chan and Annie Oakley, and we were now under the shed. The metal roof had not treated me like a guillotine. I hopped off the horse as quickly as was physically possible and turned to see my friends who blankly stared at me with fear still in their eyes. Meredith's dad was hunkered over crying. He was laughing so hard. Jim walked over and, without a word to me, looked at the horse, slapped it, and said, "Had no idea you could still go that fast." I was still a bit shaken when Meredith told me she could have sworn the sight of my braids flapping in the wind on a runaway horse was going to be the last image she had of me alive. We drove back to Meredith's home, and after informing her mother about the incident, she sat me on the porch in a rocking chair. When she placed an iced sweet tea in my hand and a plate full of food in my lap, she whispered a sympathetic, "Bless your heart." As I watched the palm tree sway and reflected on my far from dull stay in Houston, I concluded that I was ready to have my passport stamped and head back home to Arkansas.
Emily Noah is a native of North Little Rock, Arkansas. She is currently a graduate student studying public history at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Emily spends the majority of her time attempting to love people as much as she loves her dogs. In our final story of the night, it turns out that Brian Thompson desperately needs to move as quickly as possible in Still Looking for That Truck.
It was a Sunday night in 1974. We were gathered in the living room of our fraternity house at LSU Baton Rouge. Not one of those grand old prosperous who-you-know fraternities, but one of the lower echelon variety out on the edge of campus. Our membership consisted of outcasts and geeks looking to belong but not necessarily sought after. We were playing cards and listening to the evening news. One of the national stories was about streaking that was taking place at universities across the nation. Streaking, in case you're not familiar with the term, is the act of running unclothed through a public place, avoiding capture if possible. As public nudity was a natural conversation starter for us, it wasn't hard to figure out where our attention was going to be the rest of the week. Monday. That afternoon, we were seated in our customary positions at the card table, Guys were coming in from class, and they were fairly well animated. It was clear that there was news afoot, and indeed there was. A lone, bold soul had run buck naked from Peabody Hall across the grassy expanse, exiting at the corner opening by the library to be picked up on Dalrymple by an accomplice with a vehicle. Our student body was suddenly thrust into the midst of popular culture. That evening, we drifted off with hopeful anticipation of future developments. Tuesday. We didn't have to wait long. This time, it was in the basement of Lockett Hall. Psych 101. 300 people in attendance. In the middle of the lecture, someone switched on a tape at full volume of the William Tell Overture. The streaker burst through the side entrance sporting a cowboy hat, a mask, and riding a stick horse. He galloped down front, passed between the instructor and the students, gamely waving as he went. He exclaimed, "Hi-ho, Silver!" and exited on the opposite side. We all felt a slightly giddy feeling of insurrection. Our streakers weren't just risking simple embarrassment. They were interjecting insolent humor into an act of defiance. When I arrived back at the house that afternoon, spirits were high and rumors abounded. Apparently, there were other minor streaks happening all around the campus. A number of these had occurred late in the day on Lakeshore Drive. The theme of these generally consisted of a runner who would hop out of a car, dash between sorority houses, to then be picked up by an accomplice in the rear parking lot. A fairly low-risk activity if you could count on the driver of your getaway vehicle, which was actually a higher risk than you might imagine. As we ate our red beans that night, there was a sense of momentum on the rise. Wednesday, the Morning Advocate carried a front-page story of the lone streaker. The campus paper ran a column asking, "Who was that masked man?" Three new streaks were reported by lunch. Academics suddenly seemed to take a back seat in the campus consciousness. Sorority Row continued to be a hot spot for activity. About 3 o'clock that afternoon, there was a bread truck that made a slow circuit around Lakeshore Drive with two unclothed co-eds riding on the roof, waving languidly to fascinated onlookers. A few guys in the house claimed to have witnessed this, but most of it missed it to our considerable regret. This was the first reported incident with female participants. From that moment forward, bread trucks everywhere failed to pass us without thorough scrutiny. That evening, folks from around town began to park their cars and set up chairs on Lakeshore Drive in the Sorority Row area. As if rising to the occasion, small knots of streakers would occasionally appear, dashing short distances, thrilling local spectators. Thursday, by mid-afternoon, there were so many new reports that it was no longer a novelty. Multiple streaks through classrooms, a couple through the student union, one in which the participant had been apprehended, and dashes across the parade grounds. There were rumors of female streakers, though these seemed difficult to confirm, as much as we mightily wished them to be true. The atmosphere took on a sense of the carnival. At dinner, the word was that there was to be a mass streak at 10 o'clock that evening that was to run the length of Sorority Row. Several of us were considering it. About 8 o'clock, we walked down Lakeshore Drive to take stock of developments. The road was lined on both sides with cars, families, lawn chairs, and ice chests. Barbecues were warming up. The children were playing. Blue-haired ladies chatted amicably. It seemed the whole town was settling in for the spectacle as though it were a Mardi Gras parade. And as if to meet their expectations, there were intermittent dashes up and down the row. At 9 o'clock, I witnessed what I perceived as the pinnacle of our growing indifference to the events at hand. A fellow was walking hand in hand with his girlfriend, as casual as you please. All he had on was his running shoes, an LSU jersey, and his graduation tassel. I suppose he wanted to advertise his academic achievement. I'll leave you to dangle with this one. It was approaching 10 o'clock, and I made the decision to participate in the mass streak. However, I was going to wear a paper bag over my head with eye holes cut out. Somehow this seemed to make sense at the time. I wanted to look back on my college days and proclaim that I had been a risk taker, albeit an anonymous one. My girlfriend knew that I was going to do this, though I told her I'd be going incognito. Don't bother looking for me, dear. I'll be the one with the bag on my head. 10 o'clock arrived, and several of us gathered, unclothed, out in front of the house. My buddy Wayne wore a shirt wrapped around his face and carried an 8-foot pole declaring that he was a flambeau, which is a torch carrier in Mardi Gras parades. Fortunately, he didn't attempt to light anything on fire. Participants of the mass streak came jogging down the street just as planned, and we joined in the fray. At this point, we were jogging in single file, hundreds of us. I couldn't see the start, and I couldn't see the rear. With the bag on, I couldn't see much of anything. But I can tell you that the crowd seemed to love it. They pushed in so close that single file was our only option. There was no chance of escape other than to follow the guy in front of you. I remember the noise, crunching on Mardi Gras beads, kicking empty Miller cans, and having the occasional beer tossed on me. Breathless, we reached the end of Lakeshore Drive and we seemed to be congregating in a parking area. I still couldn't see much, but there was a lot of traffic milling about and car doors slamming. I suddenly realized that these people had an exit strategy. I did not. I was appalled at my short-sightedness. I peeked under my bag, desperately hoping to spot Wayne or anybody I might know. It was pretty much just me, with the exception of a few cars, looking for parking. Now, if you've ever had one of those dreams where you seem to have everyone's amused attention, only to look down and realize that you don't have any britches on, well, I can tell you that this was a whole lot like that. I had about a quarter of a mile between myself and the house. My limited strategic choices consisted of just this: do I wear the bag or not? I've blocked much of this trauma from my memory, but from what I do remember, I did a lot of furtive lurking and dashing, with the bag removed for visibility, but clutching it tightly, ready to exercise my anonymity option at a moment's notice. To stay in the shadows, I had to climb a few fences, but I did somehow make it back to the house without damaging anything important. Friday, there were no streaks at all. Not a one. As far as I know, there hasn't been another streak at LSU since. Saturday, I made my monthly call to my folks to report on academic progress. Yep, everything's going okay. Getting ready for midterms. Nope, nothing unusual. Pretty routine. Same old, same old. Today, I still look twice at bread trucks.
Brian Thompson followed his bride, Sarah, from Louisiana to Fayetteville, Arkansas, and has lived there for 32 years. He is recently retired and enjoying the subtle humor in everyday living. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writer's Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in Person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.